welcome to another podcast brought to you by St. Benedict's Table. Today we have a conversation between Father Jamie Howison and Gladiola Kaler on disabilities, ability, the church, and faith. There is a good chance you've heard Gladiola on this podcast before, either as the one laughing at the jokes coming from the pulpit, or on the March 21st, 2023 episode where she talks about her story of vocation and calling. If you haven't heard this one, I highly recommend it. And there's also a very good chance that we'll be hearing from her again in the future, continuing this very important conversation. And now, without further ado, here is Jamie and Gladiola.
So for this podcast, I'm sitting down with Gladiola Kaler, who is a fairly long-time member of St. Ben's and certainly a feature and a fixture. Gladiola, though, as many people in our community will be well aware, all of the people in our community, does live with a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And we had a small group that had done a book study on a book titled My Body Is Not a Prayer Request, written by Amy Kenney, who also lives with a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And as we were going through that study group, there were several times I thought, I'd love to talk to Gladiola about this.
Yeah.
Where does it resonate?
Yes.
Where does it not resonate? What's different? What was really helpful? What would be helpful for churches to be more mindful of from that book? Mm-hmm. As it turns out, she had also done a small group with that book. And so in we went. So Gladiola, thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And tell me a little bit about your sensibilities around Amy Kenney's book.
There were so many points that resonated with me very deeply. As you mentioned in an earlier conversation, she was very funny, which has made the book, I think, much more accessible than it would have otherwise been.
Agreed.
So that's one element of the book that I really appreciated. But she's also incredibly open and honest and raw, and there were various points in the book where I found myself going, yes, and I am so glad that somebody is actually brave enough to voice this, because this is so much a part of lived experience for people who live with disability. And just to have somebody like put it out there and have it be in print was so beneficial for me.
Which is great to hear, because I think our group, small group, found it extremely beneficial just to kind of get wakened to some of the things that she flags.
Right.
And, as you say, she's very funny.
Yes.
And as you're reading, there are points where it was hard not to laugh out loud.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Yeah.
And playful.
Yes.
Each chapter ending with the ten
things not to
not to say, not to do,
all
the things. And some of them were, it was again funny, and then there was moments where
eye-opening.
It was kind of eye-opening and a little appalling.
Yeah. So I would say, like, all of which, or most of which, have been done to me at some point. So there's definitely the being prayed over has been, I mean, not as regular an occurrence as it could be, but still more than it should be. So that's something that she brings up in the book that I, again, there's this one line that I just want to draw your attention to if I can, because it's, I think it speaks to so much of people's discomfort around disability and just suffering in general. I am the embodiment of her worst case scenario because I don't need her to rescue me. I am what every athlete fears and what pregnant parents dread. I am the catalyst for losing faith and questioning God. Theodicy runs through my veins. I am every villain in every superhero movie ever made. People call my murderers merciful because I am a burden and a drain and a waste. I am disabled.
Wow. And it's, it was that kind of, those kind of lines that would just stop our little group in its tracks.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my gosh. And is that an experience, like, for you personally? Do you feel sometimes that the burden of being perceived as a burden, or yourself experiencing, oh gosh, am I just a burden? Am I just a pain?
Yeah.
Is it that heavy that you might have wished yourself not to be?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. I think part of it was compounded by the fact that I was also wrestling with mental illness that wasn't being addressed, and I was dealing with a whole complicated, you know, family dynamic, and you throw addiction into that mix, so all of those things get compounded, and you find yourself in a space where you know you need help, and you're not getting the help that you need. But what you learn to do very early on is you learn to sort of shrink down your needs to a manageable level. You learn to make as little noise as possible. You learn not to express any emotion that isn't pleasant. So no anger and no sadness gets expressed. So what ends up happening is that you still have to deal with those emotions, but they end up coming out sideways. So as in my case, it manifested itself in severe depression for many, many years.
What sort of age?
It started at 13.
Okay.
So I would say from 13 to 15. It was a very dark time. It was a sort of a time for me sort of where I was habitually saying, you know, to God in one fashion or another, God, please let me die. Because if this is going to be my life, I don't want any of it. I didn't, and part of it for me is that I couldn't envision, it was hard for me to envision a future for myself that didn't involve me being abjectly miserable. So a lot of it for someone like me is that you don't have too many exemplars. You don't have a lot of people that you can point to who have been successful, who are living sort of happy, well-adjusted lives. And sort of, so that becomes, on the one hand, because there's no template, it can be very liberating, but it can also be terrifying. So I think what helped me when I was younger is that I had people who invested in me. I'm thinking specifically of my elementary school vice principal, Sylvia Taylor, who made it a point to go out to dinner with me and have me meet people who were, you know, wheelchair users, people who had a disability, people who were, you know, raising other children with disabilities. She wanted to connect me to those people because she wanted me, and I think I was 12 at the time, but what she wanted me to do is she wanted me to be able to envision a future for myself larger than the future that most people, my family included, had envisioned for me. And so that, I think, was profound and significant, and I owe her a tremendous debt for being willing to do that.
Was she the principal during that time, sort of junior high?
No, I was in junior high, so this would have been pre the depression.
Okay.
So what I did have, I guess, during that space of time when I was doing so badly, all things at home being what they were, but also being sort of the target of a lot of bullies. So there's a lot of stuff happening at home and a lot of stuff happening at school, and so the pressure of both of those things. But what I did have were some amazing teachers, and I'm thinking specifically of a science teacher who has since passed away, Michael Ogle. But he was my science teacher beginning in seventh grade, and he just sort of became that surrogate father figure that I desperately needed at the time, that I didn't know that I needed, and he sort of just stepped into that role. And I remember thinking, oh, this is what normal people do, and this is how normal people interact, and this is how people have conversations and they negotiate conflict or differing opinions, and this is how they apologize, and this is what happens, because, you know, none of that was happening in my home. So to have that sort of modeled for me, and to have that presence in my life where somebody took the time to notice me and to decide that I was worth their time and their attention and their, being sort of poured into in that way, that was deeply significant for me, because I went into that space being just incredibly scared and angry and I think bitter and disillusioned about a lot of things. And that was a long road to get from there to here, but I think that was sort of the starting process. Like I came out of that less angry and less scared and less unsure than I started. Mm. So that's huge.
I mean, my memory of junior high, now yeah. often called middle school, but junior high, the yeah. old 7 to 9, yeah. is that as kids were coming into adolescence, there's yeah. everybody has all kinds of struggles and questions and yes. whatever, but there's, I can remember people being so mean.
Yes.
And my junior high, there was, I remember two kids very vividly who had cerebral palsy.
Yeah.
And there were people who were so awful to them.
Yes.
And I recognized how awful they were being. Yeah. Did I sort of step in and say, hey, back off?
Yeah.
I didn't. Yeah. Because every junior high kid is vaguely yeah. terrified
yes.
of
yeah.
not fitting in.
Yeah.
But my goodness, looking back at that now and I think, oh, that's just ugly.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that those were hard years,
yes.
that's kind of when the depression hit you.
Yeah.
Because my goodness.
Yeah, it would have been a lot.
Oh.
I mean, had there been, like, I think had there been some place of safety and stability somewhere, it would have been easier to manage.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much of that to be had, so I sort of sought that anywhere that I could, and part of where I sought that was in reading, in books, and in writing, because I didn't have an outlet to communicate what I was feeling and thinking and experiencing with the people closest to me. So I learned to channel that into writing, and I did that from a very early age. So that was, I think, part of how I coped.
Yeah.
That and my incredibly dark sense of humor.
Well, there is
so
that.
That.
And
which can backfire.
Yeah, well, it can.
Yeah.
And you're a good writer.
Yes.
I mean, I've seen some of your written work, and you're
yeah.
a good writer.
Yeah.
And there've been a couple times when I did sort of poke you.
Yes.
You should publish this.
Yes.
You should
I have tried. I haven't gotten a favorable responses yet, so I'm a little gun shy.
It is hard.
I'll keep trying. Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Now, we just as we were getting ourselves set up and organized for this, we chattered a little bit about this this book group that we're both a part of. This
yes.
is a different book group,
yes.
And it's just a summer series,
yeah.
and it's a book on photography
yes.
and photography as contemplative practice.
Right.
And so you're part of this little group that gets together every second week, and
yeah.
but we're challenged in between to go out and take photographs around X or Y or Z. And the discovery quite early was, oh, look at this first set, and maybe the second, and maybe the third, all assume you can go for a walk.
Yeah.
Talk about how that...
Yeah, I guess this was 2 weeks ago now, or just
yeah.
about 2 weeks ago now, where I came into the class, and this was sort of the culmination of a lot of things that had been sort of... boiling just beneath the surface, but I came in there and I went, like, I was so frustrated because I wasn't able to contribute in the way that I would have wanted to contribute, and I sort of thought about the fact that everybody was going to be able to go for this walk and going to be able to take all these photos, and I wasn't going to be able to do any of that.
Yeah.
And so that was frustrating because I wasn't going to be able to have the kind of output that I would have wanted to have, and I had just come into that space thinking, okay, I'm just going to let it all out, and, you know, people can hate me or not, as they will. And I was actually surprised by the response that I did get. I mean, somebody actually stopped me after the fact and said, hey, listen, you know, if you need somebody to help you, go for a walk so that you can take these photos and you can participate, you know, please don't hesitate to ask me. And so that was, and that is still new to me because I, again, have not historically felt comfortable asking people for help. Because people know me as being this person who's incredibly, as you said, you know, tenacious and independent and resourceful and, you know, she'll figure it out, whatever. It can be a very tricky dynamic to have to negotiate this person who does do all these things, and yet this person who also needs help. And that's still something that I'm getting used to, knowing that I can call upon people And again, knowing, as I mentioned earlier, that there are people who will proactively ask me without my waiting to ask whether I need help and what kind of help I need, which again is also hugely important, is not assuming that you know the kind of help that somebody needs, because that's something that I've come across frequently as well, is that people will make the assumption that they know what's good for me and they will act accordingly without ever consulting me. I just remember at one point, the youth pastor at one of the churches I attended many years ago had decided that she was going to invite all of these youth to my apartment to bake cookies with me. That was her idea of an outreach activity, that she wanted to expose the kids to, like, I was this project, and I've always sort of been nervous about being sort of assigned as the project, and she sent me an email initially, and I didn't respond because I was busy. I don't know if I was taking classes or I was working, whatever the story, but I wasn't going to be home, and I didn't respond, and in retrospect I should have. So, because what she ended up doing is she ended up coming to my apartment with this gaggle of youth, and she was trying to buzz herself in on the night that I wasn't there. So we're here. I was like, oh dear Lord. So thankfully, this person who shall remain nameless has learned and grown significantly since then. But the idea that that's happened in more than one context, where it's become clear to me that there is a dynamic of we are the helper and you are the helpee, and you become the project. And that's a very uncomfortable space to
absolutely
be in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's things that you want / need assistance with.
Yes.
And other things that somebody's very helpfully going to do something that you actually don't need them to do.
Yeah.
I actually don't need the youth group to come into my apartment and bake cookies as their project.
Yes.
Their outreach, whatever. Yes. But in church, it might be really helpful if a couple of those kids would just be prepared to step up and be comfortable helping getting me from point A to point B.
Or, you know, just making sure that whatever. This was the other thing that I came against repeatedly, is I would try to participate in as many things as I could, but I discovered that there were very few things for me to plug into. So I plugged into as many things as I could. So whether it was children's ministry or the prayer team or the what have you, those are things that I would do. But I remember wanting to join a small group, and I would register and I would do this and that and the other, and I would even offer to host, but no. I remember there were instances where the women of the church had gone on retreat and I had wanted to go, and they had made the executive decision that because there were stairs, I was not going to be able to go. And nobody bothered to consult me to ask whether or not stairs were something that I would be able to negotiate. I could, and I did the following year when I went, but nobody had bothered to ask me whether or not that was something that I could do, because they hadn't seen me do it, and so they just assumed that I couldn't. And so I was told that no, I couldn't go. And so and there were numerous instances like that, or the church wanted to put on a play, and we can't have you in it because the stage, there's no way for you to access the stage, or blah blah blah, whatever.
Okay.
So there were a million things like that. So there were a lot of instances where it wasn't just the architecture that was sort of designed to exclude, it was also the ways in which I was being received and treated that served to make me feel like I didn't really fit in that space, or I wasn't really wanted in that space in any meaningful and significant way. So it was very lonely. I was there for many years. I did end up, you know, cultivating a really strong friendship with one person there, at least. So my time there was not wasted. And I mean, for that, I'm grateful. But generally, it was an experience that was not positive for me.
Right. So what I hear you say is, don't make an assumption here.
Right.
But ask me.
Yeah.
Let's actually keep an open flow of conversation. So, in this church space, There is an upstairs room that's a kind of a meeting room with its own kitchen and so on. But if we do something that you'll come to one of the groups or whatever,
we just wouldn't
book that room because that wouldn't be fair.
Yeah.
But what I certainly wouldn't do would be to say to you, oh gosh, we're going to be in the upstairs room. Sorry, you can't come to this one.
Yeah.
But are there other things like that in the context of, like, this church, it's a happy accident that it is accessible.
Yes.
There's 4 steps from the street up to the main church doors.
Right.
But then there's this very easily accessible side door that is nice and wide and is at ground level and it's easy to get through. And then there's double doors to get from there into the main church.
Yeah.
We're just so fortunate because so many churches of this vintage, this is 1924, have got 10 steps up to the...
Yeah.
And you can just get in and out.
Yeah.
But if that wasn't the case, if there was 2 or 3 or 4 steps, I couldn't say to you, sorry, we don't have people in wheelchairs here.
We don't do that here.
So, but what would be, like, what does that evoke in you? Happy accident church, but it also happens to be a really good fit for you as a community.
Yes.
What happens if it was a really bad church in terms of accessibility, yet there was some good life going on inside of it?
See, that's tough because, I mean, you want there to be the structural component and the accessibility piece as far as the architecture is concerned. That's kind of a given. That said, I mean, if I want something badly enough, because I remember going to numerous fringe plays that were in inaccessible venues, and one that stands out to me was when I went to, because Aqua Books was frequently a venue for fringe plays, and I Kelly was always gung-ho to have me, you know, go see whatever show, and I would climb up the steps to see the and Kelly was just flabbergasted. He couldn't believe
because it was up to the the performance space. I mean, that had to be 15 steps.
Yes.
Yep, I remember that.
And I traversed them all, and he was absolutely shocked. So, I mean, if I want something badly enough, I will make it happen. That said, if I don't have to, that helps. That really helps. And yes, the architectural piece of this is important, and I like that happy accident exists because, again, Amy Kenney references that in the book. The accessibility piece becomes that much more seamless and easier to navigate when it's already baked into our sort of structures and systems and policies and our ways of doing things, as opposed to it being an afterthought that we have to add on after the fact, and then we have to negotiate things like permits and money and this, that, and the other, and then that becomes an undue hardship in a way that we exclude people in that way. So that's not insignificant, and I don't want to poo-poo that, but what is so hugely significant for me in relation to this community is that it is the community that it is, and it fosters the kind of culture that it does, and it has created a space for people who I would argue historically have not felt safe or comfortable to be themselves in other communities, to come in this space and know that they can be their complete selves, their whole selves, and know that that is welcomed. And that is huge. That is not a given. So that I think has been the most significant thing for me being here.
I think it's a significant thing for lots of people in different ways.
Yeah.
The number of people who've said this is my last shot at a church.
Yeah.
And and they've stayed. And from where I sit, I am just so grateful that's the culture that has formed here. It has formed here.
It's funny because I've spent so many years looking for a space where I felt like I had full permission to show up as myself, and to find this place and to feel in my bones, this is home. is huge. And to be seen and known and loved by the people in this community is hugely significant, even apart from questions of architecture and accessibility that way. It's about creating a culture where everybody is, that there is space for everybody and everybody is welcomed. That's huge.
I can think of no better place to end this conversation, yeah. This the recorded portion, you and yes. I'll keep chatting.
Yes.
Then right there, because yeah. Because if the building is a bit of a happy accident with right. its level entries, this we did not set out to make the plan to create the community with these tones and textures.
Right.
It just kind of happened.
Yes.
And that's a grace.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you would like to support the work of St. Benedict's Table and its continued ministry, you can head over to our website and click on the donate button at the top right of the screen. And for that, we say thank you, humbly. Stay tuned. There's lots of cool stuff on the way. Until next time, God bless.